It is working. So good evening and welcome everybody to Tate Modern. My name's Mark Godfrey. I'm one of the curators here, and I work particularly on our North American collection, so it's a great pleasure to introduce this event. Tonight is the fourth in the American Artist Lecture Series. The previous speakers, some of you might have heard, have been Bryce Marden, Maya Lin, and Richard Tuttle. And tonight we're very pleased to welcome Spencer Finch. I'll be saying a few words about Spencer in a sec. But I also wanted to announce that on the 22nd of September, Julie Meretu will be here, and she will be the fifth speaker in this series. So the American Artist Lecture Series is a partnership between Art in Embassies, Tate Modern, and the American Embassy in London. And it seeks to bring the greatest living modern and contemporary American artists to the UK in the name of cultural diplomacy. And this series would not be possible without the strong partnership between Art and Embassies and the Tate. And we'd like to thank in particular Ellen Sussman, who's going to be saying a couple of words in a minute, who is the Director of Art and Embassies, and all her team for their hard work and dedication, and particularly to Virginia Shaw and Velma Lanstra. I would also like to thank the Ambassador of the United States of America and his wife, Mrs. Barzan, for their continued support and interest in this partnership. Now, Spencer is, as I'm sure many of you know, an amazing artist based in New York, but who luckily has had many opportunities to present his work in the UK. A couple of days ago, a show of his opened in Margate at Turner Contemporary. This show is called The Skies Can't Keep Their Secret, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing that. He shows in London with the Listen Gallery and has also shown his work at Bloomberg Space, at the Barbican, and in other places. I kind of fell in love with Spencer's work years ago in New York at a show in Postmasters and was very taken by his interest in starting off sometimes with kind of legendary colour references and memories, for instance, Dawn at Troy, and then his process of rigorously scientifically measuring colour and light, and then finding ways of replicating that in a gallery space with fluorescent lights and gels, watercolours, and in one case, I can remember a train set, I think, or a train that... Yeah, on a train set. So it's a great pleasure to have Spencer with us tonight. And Spencer will be joined in conversation by Sasha Craddock. And Sasha was responsible for showing Spencer's work in Bloomberg Space, where she was the director of exhibitions there and gave us wonderful shows in London, and has a very strong dialogue with Spencer, as I'm sure you'll hear tonight. Sasha is the chair of the Board of New Contemporaries and has been since 1996, and has been the chair of the selection committee for that for all these years. She has worked also at the Max Wigram Gallery and has been a critic for The Guardian and for The Times, and currently is writing a book for Reaction on British Contemporary Art, a publication that I'm sure we will look forward to. So thank you both. I look forward to the conversation, and I now want to introduce Ellen Sussman. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming tonight. You're in for an incredible treat, because instead of a talk or a lecture, we're going to really hear a conversation. Thank you, Mark, for doing all the heavy lifting, the bios, the introductions, and the thanks. I echo the thanks to the Tate, to the partnership, and of course to our wonderful ambassador and his wife to the UK, Matthew and Brooke Barzan. We're very lucky to have them here. They're ardent collectors and they're passionate about the arts. And in a world today where we look to have constructive conversations, art is an awfully good place to start. So I'd like to tell you just one little bit about the Art and Embassies program and then turn it over. Art and Embassies was actually started 50 years ago in 1963 by President Kennedy. It was formalized then. And the idea at the time was to help ambassadors who were going to post with art for their residences. The idea being that you could have conversations in these public spaces that might be difficult, and it would give you a place to start. Since then, and under the continuous leadership of our chief curator, Virginia Shore, we are doing a lot more now. Our second mission is to help the new embassies that are going up around the world, and we curate permanent collections. And in that space, we're extremely excited to be watching the new American embassy going up so close to the Tate here in London, as we will be moving from Grosvenor Square over to Nine Elms. It's a very exciting project for us. It's one in which we hope to have, you know, green and Leeds architecture. It's one in which we hope to meld into the exciting city that is London and be a very vibrant part of it. So with that little background and knowing that we're very grateful, I think we have a lot to hear about the 9/11 memorial, which I hope Spencer and Sasha will touch on. And I hope you enjoy the conversation in the evening, and thank you for coming.
So should I start?
You start.
Okay. Thank you, Ellen. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, everyone who worked so hard on organizing this. It's great to be here with Sasha, and I was a little surprised to be selected for this, but I really want to sort of do a good job. And as I was thinking about that, I decided I really didn't want to speak about my own work that much. I never thought the day would come, but I'm kind of tired of hearing myself talk about myself. And so Sasha and I are going to talk about some things that we're both interested in, mostly light and color, through a series of about 30 slides. There will be a few of my own work just to cover that base. And because I'm not quite as severe as I'd like to think I am. And it's a little bit of an experiment. I think we're not exactly sure what we want to say, but I think it's a way of really having it be about ideas, and rather than just a sort of sequence of I made this, and then I did this, and then I did that, which is not so much fun. So if we could, I guess we're in control, right?
Just before we start, you were going to talk about experiences in the past.
Oh yeah. I guess the sort of reasoning behind this was when I was in graduate school, a speaker who I guess should, a sort of famous American artist, came to speak, and whose work I admire very much, even to this day, and this was 25 years ago when I saw him speaking. But he came and he did exactly that. He just said, I did this, and then I made that, and then I made that. And, you know, it's nothing that we couldn't have gotten through looking through then a monograph or now the internet. So hopefully what happens tonight is something that you could not experience in a different way.
Yeah.
So, and that was sort of what the impetus for this way of working. And hopefully there will be some surprises in terms of the images we've selected. And also, of course, there'll be questions we'll be happy to answer afterwards. So this is a work that I just installed at the 9/11 Memorial Museum at Ground Zero, which I'm not going to speak about too much, except it's something I worked incredibly hard on. It's it's a very complex space. It's sort of probably one of the biggest things I've ever done. It's called 2,983 individual watercolors, which I made. It's called Trying to Remember the Color of the Sky on That September Morning. And each of the pieces of paper has magnets on the back, and it's affixed to a grid on this wall, which is down at bedrock level between the two volumes of the North and the South Tower. And it took about 2 months to make all of the drawings, and that was actually the most fun part of it. I still love making things, and the less fun part of it was everything else. So I did want to show that as one of the most recent things that I've done, and it's certainly connected to some of the works we'll talk about today. This is one of my favorite instruments in the world. It's not really an artwork. It's a cyanometer, which is used for measuring the color of the sky. It was developed by a 18th century alpinist and scientist named Saussure, who is Swiss. And he carried it up. He was not only the first person to invent a cyanometer, he was also the first person to ascend Mont Blanc. And so he took it with him to determine that the blueness of the sky is actually created by particles in the atmosphere. And it's kind of a beautiful abstraction and a wonderful instrument at the same time. And I've never used a cyanometer, but I sort of create my own cyanometers for my own work in different cases of gradations of color. So it's a kind of an amazing instrument from a time that when people could be like scientists and artists and alpinists at the same time. It would be sort of hard to do all three of those now. It would be great, but not so many people do it. So I sort of, it's really a wonderful sort of 18th century thing. All right. Can we lower the lights a little bit, maybe?
So, shock horror. here we have Joseph Wright of Derby's The Iron Forge. And the idea of this relationship we have in talking is that we've both suggested images to each other, and mainly they're your list, but with some help of other people, shoved a couple more in. And what we want to do is really, really, with you as well, go from one place and sort of collectively, instead of us looking like we know something you don't know, because we don't, we're going to talk about what we both see in this work. And it purely isn't going to be only in terms of light and colour. But obviously, there's some pretty straightforward things here in terms of, for instance, relationship to flame and so on. And this is a fantastic piece, and belongs to Tate. And my kind of excitement about it really is that it is a nativity, in a way, a nativity scene to the Industrial Revolution. So instead of religion, we have this idea of the family going into the forge completely unrealistically, standing so close to something quite so absolutely boiling hot. And the family is sort of the fantastic Rite of Derby habit of having somebody, you know, you've got the back of someone who's working on something and then somebody's looking out to you. And the idea is that this is a safe and great place, and it's about the future or about the present and about a sort of wish. And so Rite of Derby really, really was the first person to represent in this way. So
I love Derby's work, and it's something, this was the first image that we talked about when I thought that maybe we could do something different. And I would love to, I mean, it would be great just to do a lecture on Joseph Wright of Derby, although I'd probably run out of things to say in about 2 minutes. But it's one of the reasons we're doing this is it sort of forces us to articulate what we like, which I think is a good exercise. And I was thinking about, what I really like about this is that that the work illuminates what it portrays. There's this sort of internal integrity to it. And it reminded me, you're probably not going to agree with this, but of Robert Morris's The Box with the Sound of Its Own Making. So this is like the painting with the light of its own illumination. And I love this idea of the light coming from inside. And there's some other examples of work like that. Should we move on?
There's going to be a lot of works here where we talk about, either the material itself creating the illusion or the light creating illusion or the portrayal of light in some way. I mean, it sounds a bit obvious to say that with this here, but there is that kind of internalization, as you said, so it's like the box of its own making. So, and also it is this idea of looking into a scene, which is, anyway, enough.
And it's so much more interesting to me than, say, a Caravaggio, where you don't see the light source. And I think that the light source and whether the light source is in there or not makes a huge difference to me because of this sort of illusionism of light coming out of nothing, which for me is totally fascinating.
And we're moving now, happily,
This is my favorite Edward Hopper painting, and mostly I'm not a huge Hopper fan, but this I love. It's called Sun in an Empty Room. It's a title I've stolen for a lot of different works, and it is just what it is. And Hopper, as you probably know, could not paint figures very well, or they always look kind of clunky. And this is just so, I don't know, it's like all you really need. And it's he talked about painting houses too, and being like a house
yes.
painter, and how that was his sort of goal in some ways.
I mean, it's one of his most last, he died 4 years later,
oh, really?
One of his last paintings. And so he'd in a way doing that thing that you're meant to do in art, emptying out, sort of simplifying, distilling the way we look. But also, when he was asked by someone, you know, what's it about then? And he said, what's it after? What are you up to? He said, I'm after me. So we're thinking about who the subject is. Are we actually in that room? Are we at this strange angle? Is there a narrative? He's trying to take away a narrative. Mm. And as you said, be a kind of house builder, very functional. I think he looks a bit bright, don't you? Like over-projected or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, well, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, anyway.
It is. I mean, there's a lot of sort of subtlety in the
But it's
in
full
the
of sad.
Painting.
I mean, if one wanted to get carried away, you know, you could say there's sadness, it's kind of sexual, God knows what. But we're standing on this side, looking into the room.
Right. Well, I mean, I think there is more emotion in that than like Nighthawks at the Diner, which has all this, is sort of overladen with
That's
all this
right.
false emotion, which is
exactly.
such, yeah, it just seems so sort of dishonest in some ways. And this just seems sort of, I don't know.
And also quickly, I'll
totally
just say
complete.
That what he does is when he paints, he actually paints light as an object, you see. It's almost as if you're making a jigsaw, a construction out of these elements of light. It's incredibly
yeah.
interesting.
Yeah, and the shape.
It is
and
unusual.
And that, of course, all the paint on the walls presumably is the same color, and the way it's illuminated, it's always different, and that's something that I find totally fascinating and could look at all day long. Which brings us to this next piece, which is a work of mine. This is the other one. And this is a new work. It's actually up at the show in Margate, and it was done first at SF MoMA last year, and it's called Back to Kansas, and it's it's based on The Wizard of Oz. There are about 60 colors taken from the film The Wizard of Oz, and if you remember the movie, it starts out in black and white in Kansas, and then in Oz it turns to Technicolor, and then when Dorothy goes back to Kansas, it goes back to black and white. And so what happens is it's really... I've made some very boring artworks in my day, and this may take the cake. So what people do, and these people, by the way, were paid to sit there, is you sit at dusk. The work always has to be shown in a space with natural light, and you sit at dusk, and there's a little scorecard, and you keep track of when each of the colors turns to gray. And because our eyes perceive long wavelength, reds and oranges longer in low light than they do short wavelength, the blues and the violets disappear first, and then the oranges and reds disappear later. So it takes about 35 minutes from the time the first one disappears until the last one disappears. And they're grays, there are 12 or 13 grays that are in there as controls, so they're sort of comparisons, so when people are comparing, and it's kind of this fun thing, I mean, for me at least, because you look and you say, do I still see blue in that, or is it gone, or do I still see the red, the grays are there as sort of a control to compare against. And it's in the format, it's the aspect ratio of the original film, of course, and it is like cinema, about time and light. So it's...
I'm sorry I couldn't go to see it last on Friday, but tell me, how do people know what's going on?
Well, they have to be told.
They get it. Yeah.
Well, no. I mean, most people just
Is
walk.
It written?
Yeah. And they,
okay.
and there's a card. There's a scorecard okay. that sort of
yeah,
explains
yeah.
it. But it only works, you know, it only works once a day at dusk. I mean, it could work in reverse at dawn, I guess.
So it's really particularly performative for a short Anyway,
yeah, I mean,
really
otherwise
beautiful.
It's, you know, not a bad looking grid for the rest of the day.
Yeah, a grid's good.
I just,
a grid
but,
is really
but at dusk, it turns into a real action movie.
Oh, wow.
This is a great one. I didn't know this one.
No.
But no, I love this. It's Magritte, who I normally hate. And I was thinking about, I mean, I think Magritte is a sort of, I think of him as illustrating philosophical ideas in sort of the worst way, as a kind of illustrator, in the way that I think Joseph Kossuth is also, both artists who I loved at one point, and you know, you turn against people, and you love artists you used to hate. I think Picasso would be an example of that for me. But this is great because it's got these internal contradictions, and I think it's not just illustrating something. Mm. It has this sort of incredible kind of contradiction in it, and that's what I think is so fantastic about it.
It's amazing. It was suggested that this might be useful by a clever painter, and what I love about it is the fact that when we deal with the architecture and the bottom, we feel strangely safe. Now, how incredible. There's a sort of security. It's the opposite to creepy. It's really like listening to "I've Often Walked Down the Street Before" or something like that. It's very, very sweet. And then you have this contradiction. I suppose one could look at it forever, but there's it's the idea of the man-made light, that kind of light being of a sort of protective nature. Not that the stuff that is real nature, which is just him hacking up a sky as per usual, is not protective either, but there is something else here going on. And that,
I mean, look at that shadow
it's amazing.
From the lamp. It's
incredible.
It's
very good. I think it's sad that you don't like, I mean, I love early Magritte, those early ones are just amazing. The set scenes, the stages where you have the strange contrast of scale and wallpaper architect, not later. Anyway, it's
yeah,
nice
no,
to
I'm
talk
sure
about.
I'm basing my like blanket yeah. judgment on
yes,
very little,
on the fact
as
there
usual.
Are lots of book covers and things like that. Okay,
yeah,
and also like... one little theme that we're going to constantly have is that there are two truths or two sort of truths happening in this painting, and then there will be more works which actually carry this strange contradiction within them. I mean, it's a bit boring in art when you're teaching and people say, I don't want to be too straightforward. I want to be obfuscate, except they don't use that word. But also, I want it to be awkward. Hmm. But this is much better than that notion of awkwardness.
Yeah, it's great.
We're going at a rattling pace.
Are we going okay?
We're doing no, I think we're going fine.
Okay. Next. That's next. So now we're going to talk a little bit about photography. And the one photograph I really wanted to show doesn't exist. It's a photograph of Crazy Horse. And because no photographs of Crazy Horse exist because he was never photographed. And he said famously something like when he was asked to be photographed or offered a lot of money to be photographed, he said, why would you wish to shorten my life by taking from me my shadow? Which I think is a beautiful indictment of photography, and also it sort of raises a lot of issues about truth in photography, which is of course a big topic, which we will discuss at some later date. But this is in fact Geronimo, and there's a great story about Geronimo being photographed as well. In that he was photographed, but he appears in photographs as at least three different people. And so there's this idea of this sort of the impossibility of capturing this image of this person, of this amazing person, this amazing face, and a person who sort of looms large in American history. He was an Apache warrior and was most famous, actually, for fighting in what is now Texas and fighting the Mexican army, and then ended up like so many Native Americans in Oklahoma under U.S. Army protection. But I love that it's like he was fighting back against this idea of fixing the image, and. By changing his identity, it's a fantastic story. The thing that I'm really interested in about photography is the sort of basics of photography. I'm sort of against the camera in many ways, but I love light, so reducing it to light chemistry and time, and like this, which this Fox Talbot photograph does.
And I think that it's terribly important when we're talking about what we're talking about to deal with very early photography and the actual literal representation of something that, so, and I just got a lovely, you know, he had this, I mean, for instance, a lot of people said, Fox Talbot, no artist. Basically, he was a business person. He had fantastic patents out. He was totally organized. So the idea of him being an artist, the fact that he represented things in a certain straightforward way, fantastic lineups of plants, of china, a ladder, this fantastic relationship to representation. And then he had, you know, this fantastic book of photograms, which is called The Pencil of Nature. And the plates of the present work are impressed by the agency of light alone without any aid whatsoever from the artist's pencil. Uh-huh. So in other words, this is quite basic. And he invented many of these stances. But when you look at Fox Talbot photographs now, you just go mad for the joy of the complete, straightforward representation of something.
Right, but so much about objectivity. I mean, that's like
exactly.
He's saying it's objective, which I'm totally against.
No, I'm not getting into all that. I just really like looking at
I guess I can't really argue that that's subjective.
And I like the fact that he's not considered an artist, really, in formal terms. And yet we have now very desirable imagery.
Yeah, I guess we should have changed that out. But, no, I mean, I think that there is this constant back and forth between subjectivity and objectivity in photography. And the photography I like most is that which in which the work sort of admits its own failings and the limits of its aspirations and also probably its abilities. And this is an example. This is Walid Beshti, who works in this way, is an artist who I think is really interesting. So there are, of course, artists working today in that sort of area of photography. Christopher Williams is someone else I like a lot who sort of calls into question a lot of the assumptions about it. Because, of course, we all know that especially with Photoshop, everything can be changed. But still, there's a sort of acceptance of it as some sort of truth that drives me bananas.
Yeah. And I mean, what's very interesting is that the very relationship to the material of film is highly political at times for him. So, for instance, going through, you know, mass amount of security and finding that the film he's using has kind of got interference or has got holes in very much interests me. And also a great quote, pictures made by my hand with the assistance of light.
Uh-huh.
Which is a nice one after that last one, don't you
perfect.
Think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now we're on a roll, Sash.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That was sort of a formal connection. I decided to put in, this is the Roger van der Weyden painting that's at the National Gallery in Washington, and I was at the National Gallery here the other day and saw what the school of van der Weyden. And it's impossible to see in a photograph, of course, because photographs always lie, but there is this incredible veil, this sort of translucent veil in this painting that is one of the most beautiful things in all of art. And this idea of something being veiled and sort of hidden and slightly obfuscated, and this idea of something being fogged in, I love that. And this idea of, I mean, it's, of course, just a gorgeous, amazing painting on many levels, but I love the veil the most. And I can't really explain
why. Can't really get, but the light is very much from above, isn't it? So it's strange, so everything else is extended into this kind of darkness below.
Well, yeah, and there, of course, is that incredible clarity of Northern European paintings.
Exactly.
Which it's really sort of an all-over light.
So stuck, a bit lost for words, really, with this one. So beautiful. Of course, I could have rather boring point, but the one in London has a painting of Christ crowned by thorns on the back.
Which is
in the workshop.
Right, it's like a sign of devotion, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, beautiful.
And another example of veiling. This is a Berthe Morisot painting.
And, you know, of course, fascinatingly, the minute you have a woman's painting, you get a lot more anecdotal stuff in the books. This is her sister, the sister looking at a baby, but, you know, it's the most tender and repeat. One would be fatuous to overplay, but the fact that the veil is some kind of protection for the baby, and then also this look, the mother's look, is incredibly protective. And the sort of echoing of the arm. And of course, the curtain behind, which I think is pretty amazing.
Impressionism in general is something that's incredibly interesting to me. And I have a theory that is probably not based at all in fact, of it being something that was a reaction to photography in some way. And this idea of, especially serial work, I've really been interested in a long time in Monet's serial work, and this idea of his sort of serial attempts to understand something, whether it's a haystack or a cathedral or a poplar tree, as a way of trying to understand something from all angles and trying to get at something, and also admitting that there's this sort of failure to get it, because the light is always changing, the view is always changing, your mood is always changing, and the sort of impossibility of that, and yet this compulsion to do it, I think is something that's such a part of Impressionism, and also of working fast and trying to capture it, I think is because they all worked very quickly.
Yes.
And, of course, they went and reworked sometimes, but it was a very quick way of working, which I find, of course, very modern and very
fantastic.
Interesting. And in case you didn't get enough of folds and fabric, do you want to talk about this at all?
No, you talk about this.
I love the sort of folded fabric and painted fabric. I was trying to, Sargent especially is such a, I guess, it's a sort of a guilty pleasure in some ways. I mean, I think there's sort of,
yes.
I mean, don't people
where,
sort of
where,
think
where,
that his like...
Where is the guilt? Where's the guilt in loving something like this?
Like that his talent was wasted, or somehow that he was sort of this virtuoso that he spent his like incredible talent doing society portraits. I don't know exactly. There is a sense that he is, that he's not to be taken, you know, as seriously as even say like Whistler. But I mean, boy, could he paint! I mean, and this way, especially like just painting, folding fabric, which is something I love. It's something that's really interesting to me. I think it's just a great subject. And I was thinking of Richter and those curtain paintings, the early curtain paintings of Richter, which I love. I'm not even sure why. It's sort of basic chiaroscuro, but I think for me, it has to do with his later. Move to abstraction and how it is between abstraction and representation. I think my favorite folds are in Velázquez painting of Innocent X and the famous Pope, in the amazing red painting. And I don't know what it is exactly about it. And there's also, actually in the Veronese show that's up here, I mean, there's amazing, you know, like this pattern fabric. How do you paint
that?
I mean, I don't know if it's enough, but it's so intriguing, and it's so, and people who do it well are really great. I think there's also that connects to a contemporary artist, Taube Auerbach, who's someone who I like a lot, who does these paintings of folds. I think it's really interesting. I think her show at the ICA is really not so great, I must say, but I think what she is doing with these folds shows that they're that these subjects, these sort of age-old tropes, can be rediscovered and reinvented by people. And of course, there was people like Dorothea Rockburn did those folds. She sort of overlooked, I think, but those amazing folds in the 60s or 70s. Saul LeWitt did those great folded things. And I don't know. I mean, it's like enough for a whole show, a whole museum. So you might want to work on that, Mark. Folds and fabric. There you go, folds and fabric. It's beautiful. I mean, it's a beautiful, it's really a wonderful painting. I mean, look at how he could move paint around.
Yes, I mean, the only thing, I mean, I don't know what to say.
You don't like it?
No,
like
of course I do. I'm sorry, I do.
Okay.
But I can't bear the fact that we get, you know, into a guilt thing about subject, the fact that these are society people or the swagger portrait. I mean, they're brilliant because of that society, and the lightness of touch and the sort of relationship to the subject is totally different. But I think we should move on.
No, but if you compare it to like something like a Manet painting that has like
a lot of
subject
black
matter,
in it.
Like the assassination of Maximilian or something like that, in which there is
subject.
Sort of, and then I think that there's
but
more
you can think of other Manet paintings that are society ones as well.
Right, that's true.
So
we're both right.
Yeah. Oh, look at this. Oh. Okay, Annunciation, that Fra Angelico painted a tremendous number of these. This one actually was done, it's in the Prado, and it was done for San Domenico, the convent in Fiesole. And the other ones that are super important are ones Cell 3, which is in San Marco. But the important thing about this, that we wanted to put this in, because it's really about conveying information through light, a different kind of a message. Obviously, there are plenty of fantastically important paintings that tell you how messages are delivered in very different ways, but we have this light. I hope that... Is it okay? Yeah. This is... the fantastic thing about Fra Angelico, I mean, it's truly devotional. Now, I'm terribly unreligious, but irreligious, I mean, really. But I do get something particular from this painter that certain other early Renaissance ones don't quite do the same thing. So, you know, he really is quite something. And this particular version we've got here, we've got also on purpose because there are these other people, Adam and Eve or whoever, out there. Rushing off
well,
in a different direction.
What's great
so it's
is
a different
this,
direction.
This idea of like the word of God, like trying to make a picture of something invisible is so compelling to me.
So
I assume
brilliant.
That's what this ray of light is. It's the word of God.
Yeah.
And how do you make a painting of the word of God? And I mean, how do you make a painting of something invisible? And I think that, or how do you break these sort of conventions of painting that just shows like one scene or one thing in one moment? There's also like simultaneous narrative paintings I love that show the same person
stuff
doing three
on.
Things
like
at,
Giovanni
at, in different
Paolo
times.
Or some of
a,
that.
I think it's a Botticelli painting at the Met that's like three miracles.
That.
So it looks like it's one landscape, but there's the same, it's St. Zenobius, I think, performing three miracles. He's a very busy man doing them, what it looks like at the same time, but it's in different times. So I love this sort of break with the conventions of how we think pictures work. Mm. So, and this idea of making a picture of something invisible to me is making the invisible visible is of course.
And also, before you move on quickly, just want to say that obviously Fra Angelico is very much you talk about breaking convention, but of course he's carrying along an earlier convention with him where you actually have this actual sort of gold leaf, the material itself describing the situation. So you know, it's a two-way process here, and he's caught. And also, he always puts a column right there in the middle. I mean, it's fascinating. And one of them, the one in the cell two, cell block H, cell two, or three, it literally has a bare wall at the back. Nothing. Hmm. It's absolutely brilliant. Okay.
I think also the use of gold leaf is really interesting,
and
we'll get to that maybe later. Although running out of, we should.
Are we running out of time?
No,
no, we're fine.
Okay.
That's
this
fine.
Is a...
we better be a bit quicker.
A Reinhardt painting, obviously, which is, of course, impossible to photograph. But these paintings were incredibly important to me. When I first moved to New York, I had a job right near MoMA and would go at lunchtime and just sat in front of them. And they're so incredible. And I think what's great about them is that there's no tricks, and they reveal themselves in time, and that they're about time, and I'm sure there's so much that's been written about them, but they are, I think they're just sort of amazing, amazing works of art, and I think of sort of mid-century American painters. For me, Reinhardt is sort of the top.
he is the top because he did so many other things as well. Lectured, wrote, very, very clever.
Which is, yeah.
And there is this kind of completely different relationship. No sort of overdoing the role of the art object itself. It's just through time that you pick up that surface, which is unbelievable,
yeah.
And the build-up of paint. And it's so true. And it's, I mean, and then also he did brilliant cartoons, and he did all those wonderful things
really
that I adored
his sort
when
of
I was
life,
on Foundation. It was like discovering cleverness,
yeah.
What art is, and I think it's still true.
Yeah.
So I'm
no,
glad.
That's actually an interesting point about artists who do things outside their
yeah.
work. I think that's... Well,
I mean, completely against what all the kind of hyperbole and fuss and the mystification and the personalization and the individualization of artists at that time.
Yeah.
I mean, he was really, really right on.
And also, yeah, an artist is citizens, which I think is really interesting. Like, what an artist does, I mean, this is for another time, perhaps, but artists who think work can do certain things, and then artists who do work as citizens, and artists whose work as citizens is part of their work,
yeah,
and I think that's
right.
really interesting. And it's, you know, it's like, was it Barnett Newman who ran for mayor? One of them ran for mayor, which is kind of fantastic. Here's a Terrell, which we will dispense with rather quickly.
Yeah.
There's someone once told me that they could tell, a curator told me that they could tell immediately whether an artist loved or hated Terrell. And he immediately pegged me as someone who hates Terrell, which is true. And I think, I mean, let me count the ways. No, that's not fair. No, I mean, actually, some of the work I like, all right. But I think it's really the sort of smoke and mirrors thing about it, and that there's this sort of gestalt thing that happens that you sort of understand, especially with these sorts of works, where you have this sort of this pseudo-spiritual experience.
It's about
and then you
experience.
Sort of stick your head in this hole in the wall and you realize how it's made, and then you never have that same experience again. And I think for me, the great thing with great art is the sort of repeatability of it, and that you go back and you have a great experience, and you have a different experience, and you have a more powerful experience. And I mean, if I go back to a Reinhardt now, 20 years later, I still get something totally new out of it, or I might even see like something totally new. And with Terrell, at least with these works, it doesn't happen.
Well, I think it's something. It's a very different kind of work. It's the notion of being led in, sometimes in kind of sensory deprivation, in order to have sensory opposite to deprivation, apparently.
Which
so you're led in, and then the whole idea is that it is very important, which I think we're going to talk about a bit later. Just that notion of total experience is very odd. The relationship between your life out there and the experience in there, and it's slightly over the top.
Right. Well, this is an example of someone who does it with great success. This is Bruce Nauman's Green Corridor piece, which is one of my favorite works of art in the world. And why is it different? I guess, it's clear what he's doing. There's no trick to it. You know that it's this very narrow corridor that you have to walk through that's illuminated with these green lights, and you walk out the other side and the whole world looks magenta.
Right.
But you want to do it again and again and again. Like, you can't get enough of it. You just want to keep walking through that corridor.
Yeah.
And it's something so compelling. And it also tells you about, it tells you about yourself, and it tells you about your body and about your perception and about the world. I mean, and it's funny because Nauman is really not considered a light and space artist, but I think ultimately, he is the best light and space artist we have, and this is really a awesome. It's a fantastic work. I mean, he's great. Okay. We'll keep moving.
Okay. Lovely. 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 Lovely.
Maybe we should put the curtain ones in instead of this. Did you want to talk about the?
No. I mean, it's all. I mean, these are just. They lead us to some of the other people we're going to talk about. To the next one.
Okay. I think we both really like Richter a lot.
Yeah.
I think, especially October
17th, 1977. Yeah, the most important historical history paintings around.
Which I think are fantastic. But
blow your mind.
It didn't fit with our topic. These, however, fit with our topic. And I think also this sort of, again, this sort of verge, this sort of hint of abstraction, and that he has this whole other practice of abstraction is totally.
I mean, he made 25 of these candle paintings. Like,
really?
But blimey, he knows how to do it.
Yeah.
The light making the light and so on. Anyway, well, let's move on. Oh, this
They're
is really,
really nice
important. Leading on nicely. segue, as they say. Yes, beautiful, de la Tour, okay. So you have to think about whether he'd seen Caravaggio. He hadn't, he'd just seen pictures by people who'd seen Caravaggio.
Oh, really?
Yes. And candlelit scenes, the fact that completely forgotten, he was totally lost and forgotten forever after he existed, and then suddenly dragged out in the 20th century, you can see why. Totally straight up. You love this because of the light being obscured, don't you?
Well, yeah, I mean, mostly obscured. I mean, it's like, you know, it's in the same way of liking that I like the Joseph Wright of Derby.
Yes.
I mean, I know that the subject matter is quite different, time is different, whatever, but I think this idea of the light coming from within is so great. And then, I mean, also just the sort of, I mean, just how he shows the sort of reflection of the light, the intensity of the light dropping off. I mean, this reflection here on the table, the reflection on the clothes, the reflection on the faces, I mean, it's really... and that it's illumination and reflection. I mean, light is so incredibly complicated, and this idea of painting light, so you're using a sort of additive technique to create something that's actually subtractive in the way that light works. And so there's this sort of contradiction in it that makes it really sort of difficult to do and counterintuitive. And so so it's kind of amazing because it's, I mean, it looks very matter of fact, but it is so.
And we've got another one,
complex.
Haven't we?
Yeah, I think we do have two of them. Yeah, there. Again, it's just a little bit of the candle showing.
My God. Cool.
And also then, how do you, I mean, what kind of black do you use for the dark? I mean, what do you do?
Well, you
that?
Don't so much, do you?
I mean,
you've got it all.
No, but like on this
there.
Side of the yes. this side of the sleeve. I mean, that then becomes the sort of darkest area.
That's just a screen. That's a surface. That's a screen.
Yeah. I mean, that's actually really interesting. That's sort of what, I mean, how, I mean, that's like looking at, you know, this,
we're looking
this,
through.
This like in the totally dark up there.
Yeah.
So it's like doing that, which is really kind of great. Because it's like.
And it's slightly blinding as well.
So there is some light coming from outside somewhere.
Yeah. Okay. Now this one you didn't really want, did you?
Well, I'm not a huge El Greco fan.
Yeah, but you know, it's a pretty amazing painting because it's so, I mean, we haven't really got time to find out why you don't really go a bundle on El Greco, but I think this is an amazing, amazing painting in many ways because it's called Fable. It's very odd. El Greco did do the youth blowing on an ember before, but then this idea of bringing that really rather funny-looking person on the right, he's just interfering, you know, like in, a bit like in Velasquez, those drunks in Velasquez, you know, you feel like you've walked into a bar in Earl's Court or something like that. There's sort of reality about it, and this guy is coming in with his toothiness, and then this monkey is just... You know, probably the fable or the parable is, you know, the monkey has such wisdom, God knows what, all this stuff. But then the monkey is intelligent. But there is this strange collection of heads. Quite exciting.
Yeah. I would have preferred a Zuberon.
Yeah, right.
St. Francis.
Okay. Yes, I wanted this.
Yeah. I like this.
I'm mad about Ruscha, and you are pretty much.
Yeah,
I mean, totally brilliant. And this is also in respect for the fact that these were put in the Venice Biennale years ago in the American Pavilion, and it was a very nice show. And this is a very strange, these series of paintings, Los Angeles County Museum on Fire, 65 to 68, are important because you have this incredible sort of almost virtuoso architect's model idea of this stuff going on here. And then this insane fire going on at the back. I mean, it's so fabulous. The fire is really on fire, isn't it? I mean, it's really, and yet this is very, very calm, as if, I mean, it reminds me of a lot of the other works we've seen where, you know, it's a bit like the Magritte, where something's happening and something else is happening and there's incongruity. And we're looking at this sort of almost every angle, we're getting in every angle. So it looks like what you call an architect's impression, artist's impression that architects use. And then yet we've got the sort of...
Yeah, it's also very funny, I think.
It's very funny.
So I think that's really
Oh, yeah,
great.
I may probably take it too seriously.
Yeah, but I think fire is a great subject. And that takes us to the next one, which is the Turner study of the Houses of Parliament on fire, which I love. They're so beautiful. And... I mean, just the idea of using water to paint fire, I think, is such a weird idea.
And the fact that he got in a boat to go and absorb this.
Yeah.
He got on a boat and he said, oh, it's on fire. And everyone's going, ah. So he said, oh, out of the way, he got a boat and went off down to look at it. So there he was in the middle of the river, sort of observing this
fire. And this, I mean, I must say the studies I find much more compelling than the finished paintings. I mean, they feel so much more modern and so much...
Yeah. And the finished painting is overdone because you then look through to Westminster Abbey as if somehow that was, you know, still holding out.
Uh-huh. But this idea of how it, you know, you have this fire, you have this smoke, you have water, all of this sort of stuff flowing, which then is rendered in water of the watercolor, and the image still holds together. I mean, it's sort of he's amazing. So
okay, next one. Oh yeah, lovely. A little bit of what did I study? Yes, of economic history. the city workers. The city workers seldom painted, really, and the light in it is just unbelievable because it's sort of bouncing back off. What do you like about it?
I think it's amazing just showing the light coming off the floor, which is, you don't usually think of that as being a subject for the reflection of light, and this idea of using this floor and this sort of floor where this labor is going on with this reflection of...
Hell of a job. In a way, Caillebotte was very, very formal, you know, quite a traditional painter. He really did square out the surface. And a brilliant quote from Zola about this painting. A painting that is so accurate that it makes it bourgeois.
Well, high praise indeed.
Yeah.
we're nearing the end. So this brings up gold again.
That.
This I love this painting. It's in Amsterdam, and Wittgenstein has this great line where he talks about Rembrandt's gold paintings. I think it was actually The Man with the Golden Helmet, which is in the Met, where he says. Rembrandt painted gold.